gathered together from the far reaches of the internet are assembled a network of podcasts dedicated to the first and greatest superhero, Superman. The Superman Podcast Network is dedicated to covering all aspects of the Superman legend, featuring
The Thrilling Adventures of Superman,
Golden Age Superman,
The Superman Fan Podcast,
Superman in the Bronze Age,
From Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast.
I've got a few things to say about Superman.
The Superman Vidcast,
the world's best podcast,
and
Radio Kale from SupermanHomepage.com,
as well as the audio dramas Superman, Last Son of Krypton, and Supergirl, Last Daughter of Krypton from Pendant Audio Productions. Join hosts
Michael Bradley,
John Wilson,
Billy Hogan,
Charlie Niemeyer,
J. David Weider,
Jeffrey Taylor,
Michael Bailey,
Scott Gardner,
Cayman Stoll,
I'm Isaac,
I'm Adam,
Dave Yunus, and co-host Scotty V.
at SupermanPodcastNetwork.com.
This is the Superman Fan Podcast. I'm your host, Billy Hogan. Put on your indestructible cape and join me as together we'll crash through the time barrier and fly into the past to explore the Silver Age adventures of Superman. This is episode number 215, the Superman comic book, cover dated June 1960. Action Comics number 265 for the week of Wednesday, January 25th, 2012, and I'm recording this on the early afternoon of Thursday the 26th. Well, I'm enjoying a couple of days off after working 10 days in a row to help cover a co-worker's vacation. Yesterday was my first day off since a week from this past Saturday. But on the weekend days I did work, I only had to put in a half a day, so that helped. I wasn't as frazzled as I have been in the past when covering for, someone's vacation. But it's good to have 2 days off and get back on a regular schedule. Usually on my days off, I take care of my laundry. I don't wash my wife's work clothes because she works in an office and she has nice clothes, and quite frankly, she doesn't want me to, mess them up, but that's okay with me because anytime my wife tells me there's something she doesn't want me to do, I'm not going to look a gift horse in the mouth. So when I got home around midnight Wednesday morning, I found that my wife had washed most of the laundry, so that yesterday all I had to do was put the one load in the dryer, and then all that was left was to wash the jeans. I have to really compliment my wife on helping give me kind of an easy day off to kind of relax. Of course, she's had to put up with me for 20 years, so I can't compliment my wife well enough. Yeah, she's had to put up with my comic book collection for most of our marriage, up until my son finished high school and moved away. Had my comic book boxes crowded in the family room, and at least now, finally, I can have them out of the way when we have company over, and it's not such an eyesore. But enough of personal news. Before we get into covering Action Comics 265, I want to let you all know that I have confirmed that I do have a press pass for MegaCon, which is coming up at the Orange County Convention Center in Orlando, the middle of February. I believe it's the 17th through the 20th. I will be covering that convention for this podcast, and I'll be doing the same thing I did last year. I'll be dividing that episode into several parts, devoting them to particular panels that I'm able to record and get a good audio for, so that to share some of the panels with the listeners, as well as, you know, cover the day's events. And I do plan on covering the DC panels. I volunteered to cover them for the Superman homepage. There are several panels involving DC Comics, so I will be writing about them for the Superman homepage. And I want to thank Steve and everyone else at the Superman homepage for giving me the opportunity to be a correspondent. The panel schedule for MegaCon is now available. You can download a PDF file and print it out so you can plan your panel schedule in advance, which from personal experience I would highly recommend. But I'll get more into that when I do my MegaCon preview episode. When I downloaded the panel schedule and looked at some of the panels that interest me, it really made me excited about MegaCon, especially since it's only about 3 weeks away. So I'm taking that week off for my vacation, and I put my request in right at the beginning of the year so I wouldn't miss out. And as long as I can afford to go to MegaCon, I plan to do this every year, and as long as I'm doing this podcast, I plan on devoting episodes to the convention each year. Well, that wraps it up about the personal news that I have, and without further ado, after a couple of podcast promos, we'll begin our look at Action Comics number 265.
You are cordially invited to attend a podcast that observes the unfolding events of history. Come with me and observe the birth and growth of a legend. From the pages of a 10-cent pulp comic book to the newspapers, radio program adventures, theatrical films, and more. Witness the dawn of the superhero. Golden Age Superman. Available on iTunes and at goldenagesuperman.libsyn.com. Every legend has a beginning.
In a world where planets die,
I have come to the conclusion Krypton is doomed.
Did I hear him right?
Where good and evil fight a never-ending battle.
But millions of people will die.
Billions! Once again, the press underestimates me.
One man will become a hero.
Every world needs its heroes, Clark. They inspire us to be better than we are. Protect us from the darkness that's just around the corner.
One man will rise to the challenge.
Look, up in the sky, it's a bird!
It's a plane!
One man will wear spandex.
Well, one thing's for sure, nobody's gonna be looking at your face.
Mom?
Well, they don't call them tights for nothing.
Presenting The Thrilling Adventures of Superman, a podcast looking at the Man of Steel's history via his earliest adventures in comics, radio, and film. Featuring reviews, commentary, creator spotlights, and more. Join the adventure
at greatkrypton.com.
Lancers, I've called you here to this unprecedented gathering because we face an unprecedented danger. An enemy we don't yet fully understand. It was for this moment that we were created. But I don't need to tell you your duty. I don't need to tell you who we are.
Chosen by the Mystic Guardians of the Universe.
Recruited from across the galaxy for their bravery and courage.
The best and brightest join to fulfill a solemn oath.
In brightest day.
In blackest night.
No evil shall escape my sight.
Let those who worship evil's might
beware my power.
Green Lantern's Light.
Green Lantern's Light, a monthly podcast covering the adventures of Hal Jordan, John Stewart, Guy Gardner, and the entire Green Lantern Corps from 1984 through today.
Say the oath. Join the Corps.
Green Lantern's Light. Available monthly at greenlanternslight.com.
Action Comics number 265, the June 1960 issue, was published on April 28th of that year. It contained 32 pages for the cover price of 10 cents. The editor was Mort Weisinger, and the cover was penciled by Kurt Swan and inked by Stan Kay. Illustrating Supergirl's fourth appearance on the cover of Action, and Kurt Swan and Stan Kay were also the art team for the Superman story in this issue, which was titled The Superman from Outer Space. And this story, which was 13 pages long, was written by Otto Binder and was reprinted in Showcase Presents Superman Volume 2. And since we are only covering a single issue this episode, we will take a closer look at the contents and the rest of the comic book. And beginning with the inside front cover, which was a full-page ad for the Art Instruction League, which showed a pencil sketch of a profile of a cowboy, a girl, and a clown. And you could enter to a drawing contest to win a $430 commercial art scholarship, which today would be worth $3,205.68. You could use one of the three coupons provided and use the others to give to your friends, but you've got to act by June 30th, 1960. So if you want to enter, you better quickly fly through the time barrier, stay in a fast lane, and get your coupon in early. It began with Clark and Lois going together to interview the famous scientist, Professor Heath, who seems to have a twin in his lab. However, the second professor was actually a robot, which was confirmed when the professor allowed Lois to use an electronic detector, which confirmed that the second professor was indeed a robot, which the robot confirmed by opening up its chest panel to show its internal electronic parts. And the professor explained the usefulness to his device because it would be a detector against robot spies that would be used against the United States. I guess that way the U.S. could avoid falling behind in the robot spy race as we did in the space race. You know, maybe Homeland Security might be interested in testing Professor Heath's invention. Well, Clark left for another appointment, which was as Superman to entertain some children in a hospital. Lois was aware of Superman's scheduled appearance, and that got her wondering once again if Clark and Superman were the same person. As part of his performance, Superman punched through a brick wall. While he was thinking of his scheduling conflict, when he was supposed to meet Lois for lunch in 2 minutes, of course, as Clark Kent. So, while he continued his performance, Superman used his X-ray vision back to his apartment to activate a Clark Kent robot. And as his act continued, he used his X-ray vision also to check on Lois, and he saw that she was at the restaurant waiting on him, and she had snuck out the professor's electronic detecting device. Well, the Man of Steel checked on the whereabouts of his Clark Kent robot, which was walking in a secluded area to the restaurant, when a strange flying man in a reddish-purple costume and a yellow cape and green trunks with a stylized H logo on the chest of his shirt, flew down out of the sky, smashed the robot, and put on his Clark Kent suit, and he was an exact twin for Clark Kent, and so he took the robot's place in Lois's, the Clark's lunch date with Lois. After lunch, Superman appeared at the Daily Planet offices to give Clark the details about his hospital appearance. Afterwards, Superman flew Clark back home when actually they flew to a secluded mountaintop so that he could get his suit back, as well as learn more about this strange twin visitor from somewhere who introduced himself as Hyperman. He described himself as the Superman of a planet far, far away. And Hyperman explained his origin, which was a strange coincidence, mimicked that of the Man of Steel. Hyperman was the last survivor of the planet Zoron, who escaped his planet's doom when he was placed as an infant in a rocket, which landed at the planet Oceania. He was adopted by a kindly couple in a small town and was given the name Chester King, and eventually became Hyperboy when he developed superpowers. As an adult, Chester became the roving TV reporter for the Oceania Network and worked for a double of Perry White, who in the caption said, "It baffles me how you round up big TV scoops, Chester. You haven't the backbone of a jellyfish." Well, I'm glad that Chester's boss is as encouraging to his employees as Perry White is, maybe even more so. Superman and Hyperman then flew to the Man of Steel's Fortress of Solitude, where they sort through Superman's database in his Super Univac to find the planet Oceania, Hyperman's home planet, which was an almost exact duplicate of Earth. Hyperman was quick to point out that Oceania was named more correctly than Earth, since it took its name from the planetary feature which dominated 3/4 of the planet's surface, the oceans. They further compared notes. Hyperman was vulnerable to Zoronite, the radioactive remains of his destroyed homeworld, similar to Superman's kryptonite. He worked with reporter Lydia Long, just can't get away from those double L initials, of the Oceania Network, and she suspected Chester of being Hyperman, much like Lois suspected Clark of being Superman. And while Hyperman explored the rest of the fortress, Superman entered factors into his univac, predicting Hyperman's future. Then, together, they left Earth to fly to Oceania, where the Man of Steel volunteered to help Hyperman protect his secret identity from Lydia Long. But in a thought balloon, Superman revealed that he couldn't tell Hyperman why he planned to expose his secret identity instead. After they arrived to Oceania, Superman marveled how similar Macropolis was to his own metropolis, Macropolis being Hyperman's home city. They flew to Hyperman's Fortress of Secrecy, which was a clear dome on the ocean floor, which they entered through a super speed door, which would open so quickly that they would fly in at super speed, and the door would close so quickly that no water would seep in. And in Hyperman's Fortress of Secrecy, they compared exhibits which showed differences between Oceania and Earth. In Oceania, everyone wore pointed shoes. Their cars were, they had three wheels instead of four, the two wheels in the back and one in the front. Coins were not round, but different geometric shapes. And their paper money was not rectangular, but square and triangular. Hyperman showed Man of Steel a strange blue glowing meteor, which he called Meteor X, which he planned to analyze when he had the spare time. And on a special TV monitor, Hyperman showed a broadcast of the Oceania News Network, which broadcast news live as it happened. And at this point, they happened to be broadcasting a live shot of a shootout between bank robbers and police. Hyperman asked Superman to pose as himself, while the real Hyperman dressed as Chester. Superman asked why he didn't use robots, and Hyperman revealed that because of the rare gas zillium in the atmosphere, it short-circuited electronic brains. And the Man of Steel experimented on Hyperman's robot, which was not very smart at all, while Hyperman left to keep his lunch date with Lydia as Chester Kent. Well, Superman was able to quickly confirm Hyperman's statement about the electronic brains being susceptible to zillium, but he sent the Hyperman robot out to help him expose Hyperman's true secret identity. The Hyperman robot met Lydia and Chester at the office before breaking apart and landing in the floor in pieces. Trying to cover himself, the quick-thinking Chester claimed to have built the robot as a joke, but it only made Lydia almost sure that Chester was really Hyperman. Superman viewed the scene with his telescopic vision, and we learned through a thought balloon that he had tampered with the robot to make sure that it would shatter into pieces on purpose once it got to its destination. Hyperman returned to the fortress, bearing no hard feelings towards Superman, and asked the Man of Steel once again to pose as himself to set off the atomic fireworks display to celebrate his country's 5th of July celebration. Since, I guess, the United States, or whatever country Hyperman lives in, they celebrate their Independence Day on the 5th of July instead of the 4th. When the day came, Clark and Lydia boarded a sightseeing satellite, which was the size of a stadium, which was launched into space. Superman, posing as Hyperman, set off the atomic fireworks and flew a luminous, giant American flag in space, which got its glow from the radiation set off in space. And the flag of Hyperman's country still has 48 stars and not 50. He used an atomic cannon as part of the exhibit to blast some meteors which were flying by Earth. One happened to be a yellow Zoronite meteor, which Superman purposely deflected towards a satellite. While it bounced off harmlessly without damaging the satellite, it caused Chester some great pain, and when people came to his assistance, they opened his shirt to help him out, and it revealed his Hyperman costume. And as Superman carried, still disguised as Hyperman, carried the sightseeing satellite back to Oceania, Chester finally confirmed to Lydia that he was indeed Hyperman. Chester removed his Well, Cyberman removed his Chester King disguise and was still not angry with Superman, chalking it up to fate. And he said, well, since I don't have a secret identity anymore, he'll just be full-time as Hyperman. But he quickly discovered that he had lost his superpowers when he attempted to fly off of the platform after everyone disembarked from the satellite, but he was caught by Superman. The Man of Steel left Oceania to return to Earth as the crowd blamed Superman for ruining Hyperman's career. And during his space journey back to Earth, Superman used his telescopic vision to see Lydia hugging Chester King, telling him that even though he was no longer Hyperman, she still loved him and still wanted to marry him. After returning to Earth, Superman, in his Fortress of Solitude, would periodically check on Chester and Lydia, where, as now husband and wife, they settled in their new home. And a year later, Supergirl joined her super cousin at the Fortress of Solitude, where they watched Chester in his deathbed, suffering from a mysterious blood poisoning disease. Superman explained to Supergirl that the Blue Meteor X was Hyperman's version of Red Kryptonite, but unlike the unusual but usually harmless effects Red Kryptonite had on Superman, the Meteor X had slowly poisoned Hyperman even before Superman met him. And he showed Supergirl a printout that his Super Univac had printed out, which concluded that Hyperman would die within a year from exposure to the blue Zoranite, and the first symptom would be when he lost his superpowers the next day. And so that was why Superman made it appear that the radiations of the atomic fireworks along with the Zoranite wiped out Hyperman's superpowers to shield him from the shock of the truth of his blue Zoranite poisoning. He exposed his secret identity so that he would go down in history as a former hero. But Superman got a surprise when he saw Chester confide to his wife Lydia that he had learned the truth after all during a trip the previous week to his Fortress of Secrecy. When he learned that the truth about the blue Zoranite poisoning, and he realized it wasn't Superman's fault he lost his superpowers after all, and showing no signs of bitterness, was grateful that Superman had given them a happy year of togetherness. And at the end of the story, Superman and Supergirl sadly watched Chester King take his final breath. And Supergirl noted that Superman had given Hyperman something that the Man of Steel himself had never had, and had always denied himself, a happy year of marriage. First of all, this was a very touching story. It began as another typical Silver Age story of Lois Lane suspecting Clark of being Superman, and then it became a story about a super-powered twin of the Man of Steel who came from somewhere else in the universe. I liked Hyperman's comment that his planet carried the more logical name for their planet by naming it after what covered 3/4 of the world and not merely what covered the 1/4 of the remaining of the planet's surface. In an editor's note, when Superman and Hyperman went to Hyperman's Fortress of Secrecy, there was an editor's note which said that Superman once hid an underwater Fortress of Solitude, and which was told in Action Comics number 44. Now, I did check, and in the scan I have of that issue, there was no mention of the Fortress of Solitude, at least that I could find, in the story. So I'm wondering if the editors got their facts mixed up. That's a question for Michael Bradley of the Thrilling Adventures of Superman, or John Wilson, who hosts the Golden Age Superman podcast. Maybe they could provide that answer. And I had to wonder the shockwave that Superman and Hyperman would create by flying so fast that when they entered the hatch of the automatic doorway of the Fortress of Secrecy, fast enough so that the water would not enter despite the great pressures on the ocean floor. Not to mention the shockwave when they, inside the Fortress of Secrecy, when they entered. I guess Hyperman had everything bolted down securely. It seemed strange to watch Superman purposefully undermine a superhero. The climax of the story was the revelation of Superman's real motives. I can't help but wonder how the Man of Steel would react if the tables were turned on him. In some way, I don't follow Superman's logic totally. He made it seem like he took away Hyperman's powers so that Chester and Lydia can enjoy a year's married bliss without being bothered by anyone, but maybe I'm just have read too many modern comics. When if the enemies of a superpowered hero knew that their archenemy no longer had powers with which to defend himself, that would be the perfect time to go after them. But you know, this was a story, you know, of its era, stretching all the way back to the Golden Age, when the hero had to be chased and avoid romantic entanglements in their quest to fight crime and keep their loved ones from becoming targets. Oceana seemed a lot more advanced in their space program. They were able to launch something the size of a stadium into orbit. And I had to wonder, would it have been better to tell Hyperman the truth? Or did Superman, did the way Superman handled the situation and taking the blame for Hyperman losing his powers? And it did show something about Superman's character, that he was willing to take the scorn from the people of Oceania for causing the loss of Hyperman's powers. And Hyperman himself really showed himself to be a true hero, in that despite the ways Superman seemed to bungle and reveal his superpowers, his secret identity, as well as take away his superpowers, never was bitter at Superman or the situation in life, but he appreciated what he had at the end. He was able to spend some time with the woman that loved him, and obviously he loved back. And it was touching at the end, just like Supergirl said, that Supergirl was willing to give another superhero, even on a world far, far away, something what he had denied himself in his quest to fight crime and defend truth, justice, and the American way. A romantic relationship. One thing I do have to say about Hyperman's uniform, it was all over the color palette. Most of it was a kind of a reddish purple with green trunks and a yellow cape. I'm curious if this is what Superman's costume would look like if you looked at a negative. Now, one final note about this story. This would not be the only story when we would have a double for Superman, or Lois for that matter. Coming up, we will find a twin for both Superman and Lois a little closer to home. They would become part of Superman's Silver Age lore. While they won't appear frequently, they will become established as some minor characters in the Superman universe. And I'll give this story 4 Superman capes out of 5. A high 4. I almost gave it a 5, but for whatever reason, I couldn't quite give it that highest rating. Maybe it's the strange way Superman went about revealing Hyperman's identity and made it appear that he was responsible for the loss of Hyperman's superpowers. There's one thing about the Silver Age Superman. he's willing to go the extra mile to trick people for, you know, whatever reason as the situation dictates, which we will see in the next story, but I won't spoil that. After this story, there was, in the next page, there was a humor strip which took up two-thirds of this page. Private Pete, a humor strip written, drawn, and lettered by Henry Boltonoff, where Private Pete was chewed out by an officer for eating Indian nuts during an artillery practice because the officer couldn't stand the sound of the cracking shells during artillery practice. The bottom third of the page was an ad where you could clip out the coupon to join the Superman of America Club, and it had a, another Superman secret message which you could use, which you could decipher by using code Jupiter 4. But I don't haven't found the key to deciphering the Superman secret messages, so I will leave that to you and John Wilson of the Golden Age Superman podcast. After that was a full-page house ad for two magazines, which advertise adventures with brand new heroes, The Brave and the Bold, on sale April 28th, 1960, and Showcase, which is now on sale. And after that page, we will come to the Metropolis mailbag, which we will read after these promos for some more comic book podcasts.
The dawn of an age. The founding of a family.
You know we haven't done enough research into the effects of cosmic rays.
We've got to take that chance.
Conditions are right tonight. Let's go.
They're penetrating the ship. Our shielding isn't strong enough.
I feel like I'm burning up.
Too heavy. Can't move.
Too heavy.
We're all alive.
I feel so strange.
You're fading away. I can't see you at all anymore.
Look what's happened to you. You're changing.
Oh, Reed, not you too.
What happened to me? To all of us?
I can fly.
We gotta use that power to help mankind, right?
And so was born the Fantastic Four.
For soon the Mole Man will have the entire world in his power.
I am the mightiest living mortal on Earth. And now, mankind shall feel that might.
The Fantastic Four. Little do they dream, they're the palms in the hands. I'm Dr. Doom.
The Human Torch will be the Puppet Master's next victim.
You Earthlings can't change the way I can. That means I'm the most powerful person on Earth.
I've been expecting you, for I am the Thinker.
I vow never to return, my lord, until the Fantastic Four are no more and the planet Earth is no more.
You're in the presence of the awesome Ralatots, King of Kings, Master of Men, and Lord of the Seven Suns.
Fool, you're just a muscular freak. Blind or Hulk.
Stop! You must not end on the castle of Diablo.
My journey has ended. This planet shall sustain me until it has been drained of all elemental life. So speak Galactus.
Flame on!
It's clobbering time!
The Fantastic Four from the very beginning. Witness the origins of a legend. The Fantasticast, ffcast.libsyn.com.
Rocketed as a baby from the exploding planet Krypton, Kal-El grew to manhood on Earth, whose yellow sun and lighter gravity gave him fantastic superpowers. In the city of Metropolis, he poses as TV newsman Clark Kent, but battles evil all over Earth and beyond as Superman. Superman in the Bronze Age is a weekly podcast following the adventures of Superman from 1970 to the Byrne reboot in 1986. Follow along at supermaninthebronzeage.blogspot.com.
Before we get to the Supergirl story in this issue, I want to talk about how much I'm looking forward to looking at the Superman annuals and the 80-page giants. Now, as a kid, I always look forward to getting those extra-size comics because you knew you were going to get a lot of comic book stories. And it was great to be able to take a look back at some of the past Superman stories. And one other thing I failed to mention about in the letters page on the next to last letter talking about Superman being possibly being an illegal immigrant. I have one of the limited collector's editions from 1974, which published reprinted a classic origin story, which was, I think, written by E. Nelson Bridwell. Carmine Infantino laid it out, and Kurt Swan did the finished pencils, and it was inked by Murphy Anderson. And at the end of that origin story, we do see a panel where, in a formal ceremony, the General Assembly of the United Nations presented Superman with a certificate granting him honorary citizenship in all the member nations of the UN. So that's this letter brought that story to mind, and I wanted to share that. Well, on to the Supergirl story, which was titled The Day Supergirl Revealed Herself. This story was written by Jerry Siegel and drawn by Jim Mooney. And this story has been reprinted in the Supergirl Archives Volume 1, as well as Showcase Presents Supergirl Volume 1. And this is the 13th story that Jerry Siegel has written for the Superman titles of Superman or Action. And he up to this point, he's also written 13 other stories for like Superboy and Adventure Comics. Since the last time we covered a Jerry Siegel story, he had two other stories published. The first in Adventure Comics, number 272. He wrote the story The Superstar of Hollywood, which was drawn by George Papp, and this was the May 1960 cover dated issue. And the other story was in Superboy number 81, the June 1960 issue, drawn by Al Plastino, entitled The Weakling from Earth. And this Supergirl story began at Midvale Orphanage as Linda was helping out with watching the playground. And she helped the crying girl who was upset because she had never seen a rainbow before. So she used her X-ray vision to condense the moisture, causing the cloud droplets in the air to create a rainbow. Meanwhile, in Metropolis, Clark got caught up in a bank robbery and was forced into the bank vault with the other bank employees and customers. And he was unable to summon a Superman robot from the secret closet in his apartment, since the landlady was having his apartment repainted, which I think is for at least a second time since we started covering the Silver Age stories. So he used his super ventriloquism to throw his voice all the way to Midvale Orphanage to explain the situation to Linda Lee. So she activated her Linda Lee robot from its hiding place in a tree trunk to take her place while the real Linda Lee changed to Supergirl. After the bank robbers left the bank in their getaway car, and they flipped the switch on the dashboard to switch their license plate to throw the police off guard, as well as any witnesses, they found a girl. They noticed there was a girl riding a bicycle behind them. Well, it was none other than Supergirl, who had once again changed into her secret identity of Linda Lee and was following them on a bicycle, which we never are explained where exactly she got that bike. After a returning bank employee who happened to be luckily on an errand outside the bank, when that employee, during the robbery that is, when he returned after the robbery was over and the bank robbers had left, he opened the bank vault, letting everyone out. And once he left the bank, Clark changed into Superman and a secret alleyway. And together, they followed, Superman followed Supergirl, underground that is, and they tunneled to where the hideout was. So Superman was able to capture the gang despite the fact that their hideout had been lined with lead to block the Man of Steel's X-ray vision. Superman used the opportunity to reinforce why he needed Supergirl to remain his secret weapon, because without her following the bank robbers in her Linda Lee disguise, he might never have found their hideout and their boss. As Supergirl flew back to Midvale, she happened to fly over Smallville, where she saw a high-altitude balloon, she recognized the passengers, who were Professor Ralph Evans and his co-worker and wife Ellen, who were photographing a comet which was passing over Earth. But the couple mysteriously became blind, but the comet also affected Supergirl, making her dizzy. She fainted and fell to Earth, and luckily she crashed in a secluded area, so no one was hurt and no buildings were damaged. And she woke up a couple of days later. She knew her name was Supergirl, but that was about all she knew. In the caption, it said that she had forgotten her secret identity of Linda Lee, as well as her promise to keep to Superman to keep her presence a secret. She arrived to the closest town, which happened to be Smallville, and met a familiar couple, Professor Evans and his wife Ellen, who they were still blind, and they assumed that she was the nurse who was sent to assist them now that they had gone blind. Supergirl gave her name as Gloria Smith, breaking the double L initial streak, another sign of her amnesia. And Supergirl somehow found a pigtail wig, and she put on some civilian clothes and kind of settled in as taking care of the Evans. She noticed that the power was not coming on when she tried to cook for them, so she took some eggs and put them in the pan, and she rubbed her hand on the bottom of the pan with super friction to heat it hot enough to cook the eggs. Well, Supergirl and the Evans quickly created a close bond, and on her day off, she happened to visit the Superboy Museum. Among some of the exhibits was a statue that Superboy had carved out of a very large diamond, and a baseball bat that Superboy's had swung so hard that the ball crashed through the bat, creating a hole. Outside, Supergirl, in her civilian disguise as Gloria Smith, saw a billboard illustrating Superboy saving an aviator who had to bail out, and his parachute happened to malfunction above that very spot where the billboard was. Supergirl was forced to reveal herself when the concrete cover to a cesspool broke away from a crane and rolled downhill, and then Supergirl put the lid back on top of the cover of the cesspool. She received a warm welcome by the citizens of Smallville, who hoped that the Girl of Steel would patrol town the way Superboy used to before he grew up. And we get a sign that this is not, she didn't travel through time or something like that. When Supergirl returned to the Evans home, she began to change to her Glory disguise, but discovered that the Evans had recovered their sight, and they happened to walk in on her while she was holding her civilian clothes and her wig in her hand. But the Evans were still fond of her and wished to adopt her, but she was afraid that their lives would be endangered. But Mr. Evans proposed that she tunnel through the basement, just as Superboy happened to have done in the Kent home when he was growing up. Well, during the night, a thunderstorm brewed over Smallville, and a lightning bolt crashed through the Superboy Museum and hit a robot, which somehow became activated. It crashed out of the Superboy Museum and began destroying public property. Supergirl blocked an energy blast from the robot aimed at a chemical factory, and she saved a toppled Superboy statue, which is the scene which is shown on the cover. Then she used her X-ray vision to mount the inner workings of the robot, causing it to deactivate, much to public acclaim. Meanwhile, in a fortress of solitude, Superman was conducting another experiment in an attempt to enlarge the vital city of Kandor, with no luck. He used his X-ray vision to check on Metropolis, and finding everything quiet, he scanned Smallville and saw Supergirl flying over the city in the open where everyone could see her. Superman kept tabs on Supergirl as she returned to the Evans home and overheard the Girl of Steel mention that she didn't know what her real name was. And when Superman saw the comet in the sky or in space of around Earth, he was able to notice the bits of red kryptonite in the comet, which had caused Supergirl's amnesia. So he burrowed underground, retrieved a tank of the Z amnesia gas, which had been manufactured for the War Department and had been experimented with when he was Superboy. And this story was in the April 1957 issue of Adventure Comics, issue number 235. Superman exposed Smallville to the amnesia gas, and I added tiny bits of green kryptonite, which would affect Supergirl. Then, at super speed, the Man of Steel reprinted the last several days' editions of the Smallville Gazette, omitting all mention of Supergirl. And I guess we can assume that he gathered all the copies which did mention the Girl of Steel. And that left everyone in Smallville, including the Evans, wondering why they were unable to remember the last several days. After the effects of the red kryptonite wore off, Supergirl returned to Midvale with her memory restored, except, of course, what happened after she encountered the comet, and wondering why she was unable to remember, and her robot returned to its hiding place in the tree trunk. And Superman wondered what the next effect of red kryptonite would be, while Supergirl wondered how the world react if they knew that a Supergirl existed. This began as a very interesting story of Supergirl taking Superboy's place in Smallville. And as I mentioned before, I had to wonder if this was kind of a time travel story, but obviously it wasn't. But unfortunately, it kind of fell off the rails a bit with Superman's solution of mass amnesia. At the beginning of the story, when Supergirl helped Superman find the lead-lined hideout, I'm reminded of a story in John Byrne's short run on Superman when some crooks tried the same trick by lining their hideout with lead. But it didn't quite work because the fact that it was lined with lead stuck out as a sore thumb and led Superman to assume, well, something fishy must be going on there, and he was still able to crash in and stop the crooks. It was a touching scene when Supergirl met the Evans, and they quickly grew close. I like how it showed Supergirl's compassionate nature and showed what a mature young lady when she helped this blind couple and volunteered to operate as their nurse to, you know, help them while the Evans were blind. And once again, it was kind of sad. It was here Supergirl with a couple who would love to adopt her, but once again, for whatever reason, it didn't work out. There were some interesting exhibits in the Superboy Museum, especially the statue that Superboy carved out of a giant diamond. And in the story, it wondered why a crane needed to lift the concrete lid of the cesspool high enough so that when it broke from the crane, it would roll downhill. And how would it fall on edge so it wouldn't break, but instead roll downhill? But hey, this is a Silver Age Supergirl story. It was a cool save when Supergirl stopped the cover from crashing into buildings or cars or killing anyone. And as I said, it was sad how close yet how far Supergirl came to being adopted by a family. I was glad that Superman was able to discover the real reason Supergirl had broken her promise. And after the recent story where he had banished her from Earth just as a test, I wonder if he really would have banished her from Earth if she would have broken her promise on purpose. And as I mentioned before, I thought Superman's solution was very bizarre. Exposing an entire town to experimental gas to cause them mass amnesia for the last couple of days. Reprinting several days' worth of the Smallville paper, removing all mention of Supergirl, it's not mentioned, but we have to assume he gathered up and destroyed the original copies. I wonder, well, how did he distribute all the other copies? I can only wonder what was going through the minds of the people of Smallville when they knew that they couldn't remember exactly what happened in the last couple of days, what it would do to their mental health or any adverse reactions to the experimental gas. But this is a Superman story from the Silver Age, so I guess we can assume Superman wouldn't expose them to anything that would harm them. But again, this is just me kind of projecting from 30-some-odd years later. You could kind of say this wasn't exactly Superman's finest hour, but you know, I guess he would go to any length to keep Supergirl's existence a secret, at least at this point. Now, obviously, if you've read Supergirl stories or are familiar with her history, she's not going to remain a secret weapon for long, forever, I should say. But it's just kind of unusual to see the Silver Age stories where Superman would manipulate others for, you know, otherwise would be a good reason, but, you know, the Silver Age Superman's not above it. But I'm trying not to be too critical because I still enjoy these stories, but sometimes that's part of the fun is kind of taking these stories to their logical conclusion. That's one thing I don't want to be on this podcast is too hypercritical, you know, because these were stories for a simpler time. And back in this era, you know, the writers and creative teams tried to come up with, very over-the-top ways where Superman would solve a problem. You know, a lot of times it works, and sometimes, you know, looking back, it doesn't work quite as well, and to me, this was one of them. As far as the rating, I can't knock off too much despite my reservations about how Superman handled it with the amnesia gas. I couldn't give it a 2 because I did enjoy the part where Supergirl developing her relationship with the Evans and briefly having a family to live with. So I'm going to give it a low 3 out of 5, Superman capes. And after some more promos for some comic book podcasts, we'll take a look at elsewhere in DC Comics, which carried the June or June-July 1960 cover date.
I couldn't believe he was really dead. I didn't know what I could say to you.
Yes, child, we know. We know.
I was there. I watched him fight that thing. I watched him die. I didn't do anything but watch him die.
Lois, now listen. It's not your fault. You did all you could. Everyone did everything they could. Now you've got to get on with your life. We all have.
The battle is over. A hero has fallen.
Miss Lane, I monitored Superman when I arrived. I cannot pick up any brain activity at all.
As the city mourns, a family comes to grips with the loss of their son.
I keep coming back here to the North Pasture, to where he first came into our lives, to say goodbye.
His fellow heroes feel regret.
if only I could have helped him, Lex.
While his enemies see opportunity.
Well, now I'm back on top. And you can't do one blessed thing about it. You're dead. You're nothing. Metropolis is mine again. And you are an empty, lifeless, withering husk.
Worst of all, his true love has to learn to live without him.
Goodbye, Kal-El.
This January, from Crisis to Crisis, a Superman podcast presented by SupermanHomepage.com and SupermanPodcastNetwork.com begin their coverage of the second part of the Death and Return of Superman trilogy. Every Thursday, you are invited to join hosts Michael Bailey and Jeffrey Taylor as they explore how his friends, loved ones, bitter enemies, and fellow heroes deal with the loss of the Man of Steel. A city in mourning. A world without Superman. A funeral for a friend.
Hey everybody, my name is Michael Bailey. And this is the trailer with a truly epic ending to my new show about Batman, appropriately titled Bailey's Batman Podcast. Bailey's Batman Podcast is a weekly program that looks at a month in the life of the Dark Knight Detective, starting with the books bearing a March 1983 cover date, which is where my solid run of the character's comics begins, and moving forward until, well, at least until the books that came out in 2005, because that's where the solid run ends. Each week, I will give you a full synopsis and review of every major ongoing Batman title, with brief stops along the way to look at the important specials, miniseries, one-shots, and Elseworld stories, just to keep things interesting. I'll also be telling you what other books Batman appeared in that month, as well as what was going on elsewhere in the DCU. It is going to be all Batman, all the time, as I look at over 20 years of the character's history. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the epic ending to this trailer. You ready? The first appearance of Jason Todd. Death in the Family. Nightfall. Epic. No Man's Land. Do you have chills yet? All of that and more will be covered on Bailey's Batman Podcast every Tuesday at BaileysBatmanPodcast.com.
Elsewhere in DC Comics, there were 28 titles which carry the June or June-July 1960 cover date. Now, most of these dates are approximate because complete records do not exist for this era. We'll get a little more exact as we become closer to the present, but keep that in mind. First two titles were published during the month of March 1960, both of them DC's romance titles, beginning around March 22nd with Falling in Love number 35, which featured the issue's fourth and final story on the cover, Three's a Crowd. Although with some people these days, that wouldn't necessarily be the case. This issue is also noted for being the first DC cover by John Romita Sr., who would go on to be the second artist for Spider-Man, as well as before working on The Amazing Spider-Man as a early Daredevil artist. Although he had been drawing interior art for DC since about 1953, according to Mike's Amazing World of DC Comics at DCIndexes.com. The second issue was published around March 29th, Girls' Love Stories number 71, which also featured the issue's fourth and final story in the cover, One Heavenly Moment. The rest of DC's issues with the June or June-July 1960 cover date were published in the month of April, beginning around April 5th, with Our Army at War, numbered 95, edited by Robert Coninger, and sporting a cover by Joe Kubert, which featured the issue's first of three stories on the cover, which happened to be the 14th Sergeant Rock story titled Battle of the Stripes. Published on April 7th, the June-July issue of A Date with Judy, number 77. And there was no particular story title featured on the cover. One thing about this issue is there would only be two more issues of A Date with Judy. So if you want to get A Date with Judy, you better hurry up. Next was House of Mystery, number 99, edited by Jack Schiff, which featured the issue's third and final story on the cover, The Beast with Street with Three Lives. And also that week, which we mentioned earlier, which was featured in an ad in that we mentioned in Action 265, Superboy, number 81, edited by Mort Weisinger, which featured the issue's first of two Superboy stories on the cover, The Weakling from Earth. And finally that week, Superman's Pal Jimmy Olsen, number 45, which featured the first of three stories on the cover, Tom Baker, Power Lad. You know, I'm kind of surprised that we've never seen a member of the Legion of Superheroes with the name Power Lad, as far as I know. But that's something for the Legion of Substitute Podcasters or Super Future Friends. Check both those podcasts out, which feature the Legion of Superheroes. On to around April 12th, Black Hawk number 149, which featured the issue's third and final story on the cover, The Fantastic Fireworks Master, along with My Greatest Adventure number 44, edited by Jack Schiff, which featured the issue's first of three stories on the cover, We Fought the Beasts of the Petrified Island. And finally that week, Sugar and Spike number 29. Published around April 14th, Batman number 132, edited by Jack Schiff, which featured the issue's third and final story on the cover, The Lair of the Sea Fox. Next, the June-July issue of Challengers of the Unknown number 14, which featured the issue's second and final story on the cover, Captives of the Alien Beasts. Also that week, the June-July issue of Heartthrobs number 66, which featured the issue's fourth and final story on the cover, I'll Love You Forever. And finally, on that date, House of Secrets number 33, also edited by Jack Schiff, which featured the issue's third and final story on the cover, which starred the 11th Mark Merlin story titled The Monster of the Mountain. Published on April 19th, 1960, the June-July issue of The Adventures of Bob Hope number 63, as well as the June-July issue of The Fox and the Crow, number 62, which featured four stories of those characters, along with one Hound and the Hare story, as well as also that on that date, G.I. Combat, number 82, also edited by Robert Coninger, and the June-July issue of that title. And finally on that date, Tales of the Unexpected, number 50, edited by Jack Schiff, which featured the issue's third and final story on the cover, which was happened to be the 13th Space Ranger story, titled Menace of the Sun Creature. Published around April 21st, the June-July issue of Flash, number 113, featuring the issue's first of two stories on the cover, Danger in the Air. And this was the 9th Silver Age Flash appearance. And this story also featured the first appearance and origin of the Trickster. Also released on this date, or around this date, Mystery in Space number 60, edited by Julia Schwartz, which featured the issue's first of three stories on a cover, which was the 11th Adam Strange story, titled The Attack of the Tentacle World. And finally, on that date, World's Finest Comics number 110, edited by Jack Schiff, which featured the story titled The Alien Who Doomed Robin. And in the back of this issue were stories which featured Tommy Tomorrow and Green Arrow. Published around April 26th, the June-July issue of All-Star Western, number 113, edited by Julius Schwartz, which featured Johnny Thunder in Challenge of the Outlaw Horse. And this issue also featured stories starring Foley of the Fighting Fifth and the Trigger Twins. And finally, released on this date, Detective Comics number 280, edited by Jack Schiff, which featured the Batman and Robin story, The Menace of the Atomic Men. And Roy Raymond and Martian Manhunter also starred in stories in this issue. And finally, published around April 28th, 1960, along with Action Comics number 265, Adventure Comics number 273, featuring the Superboy story, The Boy Who Was Stronger Than Superboy. And this issue also featured Aquaman stories starring Aquaman and Congo Bill. Also published on around this date, the June-July issue of The Brave and the Bold number 30, edited by Julius Schwartz, which featured the third Justice League story titled The Case of the Stolen Superpowers. Also released around this date, the June-July issue of Star-Spangled War Stories number 91, edited by Robert Conniger, which featured the issue's first of three stories on the cover, which starred Mademoiselle Marie in her eighth story titled The Train of Terror. And finally, for this month, Strange Adventures number 117, I forgot to write down the editor's name, but I believe it may have been Julius Schwartz, which featured the issue's first of two stories on a cover, Challenge of the Gorilla Genius, another classic DC Gorilla cover. It also featured the first appearance in the origin of the Atomic Knights in Rise of the Atomic Knights, written by John Broom and drawn by Murphy Anderson. And that wraps up our look at Action Comics number 265 and the other DC titles that were published during this month. Next episode, we'll take a look at the Superman Family comic book, cover dated May-June 1957, World's Finest Comics number 88, where we will also discuss the results of the DC 5000 Prize Slogan Contest. In 2 weeks, we will look at the Superman comic books, cover dated July 1960, Superman number 138, and Action Comics number 266. And in 3 weeks, we will take a look from our regularly scheduled journey through the time barrier, and take a break from flying into the past to explore the Silver Age of Superman comics. And I will do my now, hopefully, annual MegaCon preview episode, along with other episodes, as I can present them from that weekend, where I will share my experiences and some of the panels and guests I hope to meet at MegaCon this year. This concludes another episode of the Superman Fan Podcast. The home website is thesupermanfanpodcast.blogspot.com. Episodes are also available on iTunes and most other podcast aggregators, as well as supermanfanpodcast.wordpress.com and the Internet Archive at archive.org. Your emails are always welcome at supermanfanpodcast@gmail.com, and I look forward to reading them. The Superman Fan Podcast is a proud member of the following: the League of Comic Book Podcasters at comicbooknoise.com/league, the Comics Podcast Network at comicspodcasts.com, the Superman Web Ring of Websites, and the Superman Podcast Network, which you can find at www.supermanpodcastnetwork.com, where you can find podcasts covering every era of the Man of Steel from the Golden Age to today. The theme music for this podcast is titled Plans in Motion, composed by Kevin MacLeod, part of the royalty-free music library at incompetech.com. You can join the Superman Fan Podcast group and page on Facebook, and follow the podcast on Twitter at Superman Podcast. Superman and all related characters and images are trademark and copyright of DC Comics. Any artwork displayed with the show notes is for entertainment purposes only. I make no claim of ownership to the images shown, nor do I earn any money or profit from this podcast. Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Superman Fan Podcast. Join me next week as together we'll crash through the time barrier to fly into the past and explore the Silver Age adventures of Superman. And don't forget to wear your red indestructible cape. As always, thanks to Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, creators of Superman.